Welcome to Hometown to Hollywood. This is Bonnie Wallace, author of The Hollywood Parents Guide. And today my guest is Grammy-nominated songwriter and author Shelley Piken, who has written songs for Brandy, Natalie Cole, Celine Dion, The Pretenders, Britney Spears, Jessie J, Demi Lovato, Selena Gomez, Inks, Backstreet Boys, Keith Urban, and many, many others. Number one hits, What a Girl Wants, and Come On Over Baby, All I Want Is You by Christina Aguilera, and number two hit, Bitch by Meredith Brooks. For Disney Descendants fans out there, Shelley is also co-writer of Rotten to the Core, which is approaching 200 million views and about to be double Vivo certified. She's also the author of the excellent book, Confessions of a Serial Songwriter. Shelley, welcome to the podcast.
Nice to be here. Hi, Bonnie.
We first met in the recording studio a couple of years ago when Duff was laying down her part of the tracks on Rotten to the Core, which turned into a crazy, huge hit.
Right.
Now, did you know the song was going to be big when you wrote it?
No. It felt good, though. And that's usually enough for me. You know, if a song feels good, it's gravy if it does well. But what's important is that it just feels good coming out.
Now, I read something about a bathtub being involved.
Yes,
in the writing
of this song. Bathtub was involved. Would you like to know the detail?
I love the story.
So I was on a college tour with my daughter, who was a junior in high school at the time, and Stephen Vincent from Disney called me as we were walking across Wesleyan campus. And I swore to myself I wasn't going to take phone calls, but I make exceptions for Stephen because he's just so lovely. And it was work. He said, I've got this great piece of music, and I'd love you to hear it. It's for this movie we're making, and sort of like, I hear it sort of like Officer Krupke from West Side Story, and he just painted this picture, and I never say no to him, not because I'm obligated, because he always has really fun projects. So I said, I'd love to hear the piece of music, but you should know I'm away. So wherever the producer is who did this piece of music, I'm not going to be able to get in a room with them because I'm on the East Coast. So he said, listen to the music and let's talk tomorrow. I listened to the music and I loved it. And the song wrote itself. It just, I knew what I wanted to say. The words just came. And then I thought, well, how could I not do this? It's already written in my head, but how am I going to record this? So usually, you know, you go into a studio. It doesn't have to be a real big studio. It could be somebody's bedroom, but you need a microphone and you need an engineer. I had none of those things. So we were staying at the London in New York, and I just went into the bathroom and I closed the door and I got into the bathtub where I knew there would be some kind of a little bit of reverb with my laptop on my lap. I didn't have a microphone. I was just hunched over the keyboard, no headphones either. And I just sang, and there was, I guess, what we call bleeding all over the musical tracks. My voice was, but the point is, the song was there. The idea was there, and I sent it in, and everybody loved it. And there were a couple of lines that they wanted to rearrange, put this in the first verse, because Kenny Ortega was involved, and he was saying, well, maybe Dove should sing this line, and maybe someone else should sing that line. So I rearranged it, and when I got back to Los Angeles, I went into a real studio. This is a very long-winded answer.
No, it's great. I love this.
And I recorded it, everything correctly. All the lines where they wanted them, in a proper studio. And they came back and they said, well, we're still using this song, but what happened to that scratchy vibe? So what do you mean? I did it in the bathtub. They said, get back in the bathtub.
Get out.
So I went back in the bathtub. I wasn't at the London in New York. I was home. And I re-recorded it. And that's my demo.
Oh, my God. Scratchy.
Couldn't have planned it that way. There was like, there was some kind of something, je ne sais quoi. Like, it was Well, you know, it was, the vocal was more like, they call me this, they call me that. It didn't have to sound like Adele.
Yeah. But that actually translates onto the final product. That vibe is there. I think it's part of what's so appealing about the song.
Maybe.
I love it.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Myself, yeah. I know that it's the anthem for a lot of people out there.
Kids, you know, I go on book readings now. I was in Nashville, and one of my followers on Facebook down there, you know, she brought her 8-year-old to come see me, and she was all about Rotten to the Core. And there's not just eight, like the mother loved it too. It was a nice little surprise. It was a treat for me.
Well, so this is perfect. So how does it work when you get asked to submit a song for a movie or a TV show? What is that process like?
Well, in general, it could be different than how it is with Disney. With Disney, it's usually a competition. And I know that there's a handful of songwriters that the A&R people reach out to. And we're given a brief. They give us as much information as they possibly can give us, sort of like ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And now go bake the cake. Ordinarily, I wouldn't love writing in that kind of process. But everybody's out upfront about everything. And, you know, I switch around the way I write. Sometimes late at night, I turn out the lights. I go back and I read a diary from when I was a teenager. I feel my heart break again and I pour my heart out. You can't compete for that stuff.
No, that stuff's gold.
Because that stuff, and that stuff is just so unique to you. But I don't want to do that every day. It takes a lot of energy. And sometimes it's really fun to get in the room with a colleague, or this colleague I met virtually, I never even met him, and now we have Rotten to the Core, and have a contest.
Mm-hmm.
I have written stuff with Sam Hollander, and we've gotten gigs together, and then I have written with somebody else and competed with Sam Hollander, and we're all happy for each other. Of course, not as happy as when we get it, but it's a community, and we cheer each other on. And Steve, you know, calls back and when we submit the song, and he lets us know if certain lines won't work or if certain word is too racy, and we adjust, and then we wait for good news. The nice thing is if we don't get the gig, he usually rips the Band-Aid off very quickly and lets us know, and then we dust ourselves off and go on with our life and compete for the next one.
Wow.
And, you know, if you do enough, you get one.
Now, writing a song for a specific project isn't, in fact, how most of your work has been done, and it's not, in fact, how most songwriting does work, right? So what does a more normal writing process for a pop song look like these days?
So I, well, let's back up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work more with another, I call it a serial songwriter, somebody that's just passionate and faithful to just getting up and writing a song every day and then saying, okay, where can we pitch this? And I used to do a lot of that. We'd write a song and then say, who would this be good for? Would it be good for Britney? Would it be good for Kelly Clarkson? A lot of artists getting in the room now co-writing, and there's a lot of reasons for that, and some of them are good, some of them are not so good. But if I'm going to compete with an outside song and compete with a song that an artist wrote for themselves, it's going to be very difficult, and my chances of getting on their record are greater if I get in a room and write with them.
Yep.
So, to be honest, there are some recording artists out there who should be songwriters. They have a lot to say. They have a good idea of how to construct a song, where the emotional arc should be, what the ingredients are. And I get a lot of joy writing with them. There are certain recording artists that really are there in name only, because it's hard to make a living. It's harder to make a living now, being a songwriter, being an artist. And so I guess there's a lot of managers telling their clients to get in the room because that's another income stream.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tricky. It's tricky. You know, sometimes you've got to go in that room to find out. But sometimes you have a great idea and it gets diluted, because if you get in a room with someone who can't really write that well, you know, you're taking a chance.
Well, you're sort of like being set up on a blind date, aren't you?
Exactly what it is. And that's the way it is with anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get in the room sometimes with Billy Steinberg, who I admire more than anything in the world. He wrote I Stand By You. He wrote I Touch Myself. He wrote so many big hits, so emotional. We don't write great songs together, but I love him. He's a hoot, you know? So it is sort of like you got to...
Chemistry. It's about chemistry.
Yeah. I mean, we have social chemistry, personal chemistry. Just write the best songs. So I'd rather go out for a meal.
Well, we all have relationships that, you know, are strong in certain areas, mm-hmm. and you know, just not really there in other areas, and you have to try that out.
Right.
So these days, do you have regular writing partners you like to get together with, or how does that work?
I get together with, I rely on Sue Drew, who's at Cobalt, who will set me up with people who are actively, artists who are actively making records. Honestly, Bonnie, I used to get a demo from an unknown, and if it spoke to me, I'd say, I want to write with this person. I wish I could say it was like that now, but things have changed. You know, I talked to, I think we might get into this later, and maybe I'm skipping too far ahead, but when I was coming up in the business and albums in full form sold, you could write a song, and if it was accepted to be recorded on an album as an album cut, not a single, so it would never be on the radio, it was still a great thing, because if an album sold a million copies, which was pretty common, and you wrote that whole song or you co-wrote that whole song and you did a few of those a year, you could make a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. In 1990s, that was awesome.
That's
even
amazing.
Now, it would be awesome. So I was earning a nice living and I would write with anybody. And if I got an album cut, I was fine. But now you really have to get the single. If you don't, and there's a lot of wasted time if you just get up every day to write and pitch songs, because those songs aren't being received. Not as many A&R people or gatekeepers of albums are looking for the song that maybe will change the world. They really want songs that maybe their artist co-wrote, which might not be as good. And if the artist has a following and a momentum, that matters more than it ever did because of social media. So there's a whole lot of stuff that has changed. That said, I made some decisions in my life since I wrote my book. I sort of started writing it because I was confused, and I wrote my way to some answers that I didn't even know. I didn't even know there were questions to these things. And I decided no matter what I do now, I need to at least believe I am getting up and looking forward to the company I'm going to keep that day. If I wake up and go, oh my God, I've got to go to this session and I'm excited about it. I didn't like any of the music I heard. Why am I going?
Yep.
I think if you're 20, if we're an 18-year-old aspiring songwriter asks me how to go forward, I say do everything. Experiment. Test the waters. Write with people who you're not sure you're going to love working with. You might love it. And just do everything. But I feel like I'm at the point in my life where I've done that and I have a little better idea of what I'm going to enjoy. And that's how I move forward. That said, you just never know.
You
might think you're not going to love something and then you come home and you did.
And I love the surprise aspect of any creative work that way. You know, it's very interesting what you said about the change from buying whole albums to basically people just buy singles now, right? And so in a way, every song almost needs to have the strength of a potential single.
Or
which
memorable.
Is a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Has to be extra hooky, if you will.
Right.
And I can see how that would sort of alter the whole songwriting
process.
You know? I mean, it alters the texture of what kind of musical experience is available to us as people. You know, I think about the albums that I grew up with, and a lot of my favorite songs that spoke the most to my heart
were sandwiched in between the singles.
Were never singles, would never be singles, ever. But they were the ones that I looked for, that I leaned on, you know what I'm saying? And those songs probably wouldn't have made it today. And that's a shame, because the quality of that kind of song is important to us as human beings, but we're not getting as much of that because of the sort of filtering process.
You're preaching to the choir. I'll go to a session, and if I want to write something deep and meaningful, and I hear, we got to get the single, and the single is sound bitey, and it's hook after hook after hook, and I dig that. You know, I hear them on the radio. I love, you know, Habits and Tove Lo, and I love some of that stuff. But I also love, I like my plate filled with my protein and my vegetables and my carbs. You know, I like the... And, you know, I also love the album experience. I love to be taken on a journey. You know, I wrote a post the other day that I do subscribe, and I streamed an album, and I like to listen to the whole thing. And my Apple playlist defaulted to shuffle.
Ugh.
And I didn't care for the first two songs I heard. And then when I figured out how to unshuffle it, I listened again in the order with which the recording artist wanted me to hear that journey.
Yeah.
And I got it.
Yeah. Context.
You know, he eased me in, and I went over and over. I have this fantasy that young kids are going, or young recording artists are going to, in a couple of years, come up with this new idea. Let's make this thing called an album.
Oh, I see it. It's coming.
Let's make 13 songs, and you know what else I'm going to do? I'm not going to let my tracks be accessed. You have to hear my whole story. Now, who's going to be brave enough to do that? Who's going to be, I mean... Beyonce, didn't you do that on something?
Yeah, so.
You have to, I guess, have some kind of power at your label to say, look, I don't want people to be... I'm more than this slice of pie. I am this whole thing, and nobody is going to know my whole story from this one piece of pie. I'm deeper than that. And I think culturally our music is so much more diverse and richer, peeling back the skin on the onion and finding out who an artist is.
Yeah, no, it's, I don't know. It's a thinner experience to only have access to sort of, I don't even know how to articulate this. It's like what we all think is going to be the popular songs, and so those are the only ones that are made available through a single process, and the ones that, you know, feel dicier, they don't even have a chance.
You know, I think a lot of it, Bonnie, also has to do with the attention, the multitasking, social media, attention spans. Everything is vying for our attention. So if a young person, I think we come from a culture where we can give something a little bit more time. We slow cook a meal. Everything is very fast food now. And, you know, you could be listening to a song, but if the TV is on in the other room or Hulu's on your computer screen and it's going to attract your attention, that song has to win you over. By the time the intro is finished, the intro has to be a hook, the verse, all sections have to be
a hook. Like, what is the chorus? They're all hooks. They're all chori. So there's no easing in. There's no foreplay.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a G-rated sense.
We
and
can
I don't
say that.
Mean that in a racy way.
Yeah.
There's no young ladies. I would like to see young ladies when they start dating young men to have a conversation, to go out for an ice cream before they kiss.
Yep.
You know, but I feel like it's just like, let's just have that kiss, shall we?
Cutting
Where's
straight
the
to
romance?
It.
Where's the pursuing? Where's the what's that word? The
wooing.
Not the schmoozing, the wooing, but yeah.
Well, and
the courting.
And, yeah, the courting and the shades, the texture. I found it really interesting. So my daughter Dove is in this duo with her sweetie Ryan, the girl in the Dreamcatcher, and they just released an EP, so a baby album. So
I've
cool.
I've got to hear that.
I think you'd really like it. I think you would. I really like it. And a lot of people my age really like it. It seems to be speaking to people of different age groups, which is super cool. And it's a very organic mix of stuff. It's got its own little arc to it. It's got an order to it. And there's a couple of songs on there that are fairly dark. One of them is a pretty dark ballad, and they were a little worried, you know, that their audience might not really vibe with it the way they would with the hookier, bigger stuff.
Right.
And the response has been amazing. Those two songs that they were the most concerned about seem to be the favorite songs, which is just, it gives me a lot of hope.
Good for them for putting them out.
Well, people are looking for, I think, something that
depth.
Speaks a little more, something
yeah.
with more depth. Yeah, I don't
yeah.
know how else to say it. Things that are not just like so hot and obvious.
Surfacey.
Yeah, yeah. So
yeah.
I just wanted to sort of put that out there to share that that's like been our immediately recent
mm-hmm.
experience with that
I
experiment.
I need to hear that.
It gives me a lot of hope.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a huge audience out there, but people just need to have faith in that
mm-hmm.
and share what they have that is more from their heart, is
right.
a little riskier, is a little darker,
right.
more complex.
And you know what? It's so much more interesting. I am so much more interesting I'm so much more interested in myself as a human being when I'm sharing my insecurities, my darkness. You know, so many songs are played on the radio based on or written based on algorithms, you know, so they're already thinking what sounded like the last song. Does it have the same tone range? Does it have the same word in it? So many songs sound like the same singer.
Well, literally,
they're singing through the same microphone. There's no distinction.
Like reverse engineering a hit to
yeah.
the best of their ability, which has
yeah.
zero soul in it. And somehow, at some level, I think most people really recognize that viscerally. And I think, to me, art in general and music in particular, it's here to reflect our experience
mm-hmm.
as human beings and to resonate with us and to, you know, help us feel those feelings.
I bet you was there part of Dove that says, I just need to do this because I need to speak in my own, I need to say things, you know,
oh,
in
yeah.
my own voice. And I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd
yeah.
love to hear that. You know who I'm really digging on is this young girl, is it Daya or Daya?
I'm not sure.
She does the song Sit Still Look Pretty. And she does, what's the song about the boys? Where are they? It's called, this is what happens when I stop thinking about it. It will come. But it's such a, it's sort of like a Lord type production. So it's sort of edgy and sparse. But she's not relying on, Hideaway. Is her other song, where'd all the good boys, you know, hide away, where are they? It doesn't sound squeaky clean, but she's not talking about touch my body, touch me there, let's go to the club, when are you going to touch me?
Right.
Honestly, and I have to say, it's not because I'm older. When I was 18, I would have been bored with that stuff.
Yeah.
Talk to me about something else other than touching my body. Anybody could say that.
Because it's actually boring.
I think it's boring. You know, it's not boring if you're in a club.
Okay.
And you're dancing and, you know, you want to feel your heartbeat with the bass drum. I get that. But like driving in my car or floating in my pool?
No.
Talk to me about something. Tell me something I don't know.
Yeah, a little complexity, a little
and
texture.
And I promise you, it's not because I'm an adult. I was never into it. And my kid is 19. And she wants to hear something with more depth, too. So, good for her.
Well,
you know?
Speaking of teenagers, you started writing songs when you were a teenager, which I just love. You know, because that's a time that we're exploring our passions, and we often do land on our passion that we're going to pursue all of our lives at that point in our lives. But interesting to me, you didn't consider that as a possibility for something that you might do with your life until actually you were out of college, and when you were in college, you didn't even study songwriting.
I did not.
And part of what I love about that is I think there's this kind of myth. Hey, Fern. Fern's
hey,
making...
Fern. Fern wants a record deal.
Fern wants to sign with a good label. Mm-hmm. Fern, you can do it yourself now. She always makes a cameo. You can self-produce,
she's a sweet
Fern.
Kid.
You're a cat. Anyway, I think there's this kind of pervasive myth right now that keeps a lot of people from going after their dreams and doing what they want to do. And the myth is that they have to be degreed in something. They have to have like somehow been, you know, stamped and approved, and they studied it to make a living doing it. And I just see so much evidence that that's not true. So when was it, you go all the way through college studying something completely different, that you realize, I could do this. I could maybe make a living as a songwriter.
Yeah.
What a crazy thing.
You know, we didn't have, you know, everybody's a songwriter now. I feel like you can do it yourself. You can write a song and be in the middle of the country and put it up on... And it's more obvious that we can all do it because of all the Voice and American Idol and everybody's singing and everybody's a star and everybody's writing songs. When I was growing up, that wasn't the case. Any song I heard on the radio, I assumed was written by the person who sang it.
Oh, yeah.
And I went to college. I had other interests, too. So, you know, I loved designing clothes, and I loved... So I went to college, and I was studying merchandising and designing clothes and buying and selling. But I always loved to write. Oh, Fern likes me. So I would run up to the Fine Arts Building every day after class and lock myself in a tiny little room in a piano cubicle and write songs. But it was my... It was a hobby. I just didn't realize. I thought, well, am I going to really make a record? It just... And I didn't live in Hollywood. I grew up on Long Island. No, I didn't even know another songwriter. Even in college. Can you imagine? It's like my kid was growing up. All of her friends were songwriters. They all wrote songs. I didn't know anybody else who did it. So I didn't have a community or a resource. It was just a fantasy, really. When I got out of college, I came to New York City, and I had a couple of interviews in the garment district, and I wasn't sure that the culture, after all that education and buying and everything, was the culture I wanted to be in. And I was looking in the newspaper one day, and
I saw
this advertisement for this songwriting workshop, and I said, what?
This is a thing.
This is my tribe.
Oh, man.
Oh, my Lord in heaven. And I got there. And I walked into the room that night. It was in a back room of a bar in Midtown Manhattan. And everybody had a guitar. There was a keyboard up there. And we all played each other our songs. And I thought, I feel like I found my planet. This is amazing. And I got a job waiting tables. And I actually loved waiting tables, and my father was like, oh my God, I just paid him. But all they wanted me to do was be happy.
Yeah.
And waiting tables just, you know, supported my habit. And I found other songwriting workshops, and I found other songwriters. And I just, I wrote songs every day. And there was a beautiful network. There was a lot more opportunity to get on albums because full albums were selling. And people were not close to their, they didn't hold their cards close to their, they shared information. And I wound up getting my song on a record. And that first record sold 3 million copies. And publishers came after me for the sub-publishing of that one song, I was able to make a deal and quit my job.
Oh, that's amazing.
One song.
How old were you?
Well, I was in my 20s by then.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's still something. That's still really young to start to go, I can do this.
I can do this. And I was able to... Then I played piano bars a little bit in New York City in a hotel. I got my chops together. I could just go plonk, 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 plonk and sing over them. I would never have made it as a singer, but I got all these like thrift store fancy dresses and teased my hair and went in and said, I could be your piano player. And they believed me and I did it. You know, you got to fake it till you make it. And I had, you know, I just did. We are fearless when we're young. Being young is wonderful. You get away with so much when you're young because you're young. I feel like I'm hitting my second youth when we start being afraid to try new things again. That's when we grow old. And I'm not ready to do that.
I am with you 100%.
And, you know, I think it's great that Dev put this album out. I can't believe I haven't heard it yet. I will access.
Yeah, yeah.
I will go out and buy the CD, or I will access.
Yeah, yeah. I'll play a track or two for you when we're done here if you have time. Well, so the landscape of the music business has changed a ton since you started writing, and it's actually just changing practically as we speak. I think of it as the Wild West at this point.
Yeah.
So streaming technology and how music is distributed have totally changed the game. But at the same time, the one thing that actually hasn't changed at all, amazingly, is music copyright law. And it hasn't been updated, I just found this out, since 1909, which is over 100 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, practically recorded music almost didn't exist back then. So can you walk us through just a little bit of history so we can understand what's happening to songwriters today financially?
Right. Well, in 70 years ago, the consent decrees came into effect to prevent antitrust behavior. And rather than get all legal, because this stuff is very confusing and I'm just starting to wrap my head around it, basically, rates were put into effect that determined what a songwriter could make from their licensed music. And this system worked all right in an analog world, pre-digital. Did we get paid enough? Maybe not, but it was enough. I mean, did we get paid as much as we were supposed to? Maybe not, but it was enough. So everybody didn't get all riled up about it. But our hands, songwriters' hands, were tied by these consent decrees. We weren't allowed to navigate in a free market. There's no other profession that is regulated by the government like we are. You make a product, you take it out, you test the waters, and you say, so-and-so would pay me $20 for this, but so-and-so would pay me $50, so I'm going to sell this for $30 or $40. People, or manufacturers and distributors are allowed to determine what they're going to charge for their product.
Sure. I mean,
songwriters are not allowed to do that.
If you're a painter and you make a painting, you can decide to sell it for $5 or $5,000. Yeah, exactly.
So our hands are tied. Record labels were not under these consent decrees, and their hands weren't tied. They can charge whatever they want. Now, when streaming, when record format went away and physical copies stopped being sold, then there were the download, there were CDs, and then there were downloads, but all these things were actually considered mechanical copies, physical copies. You could purchase them. When they were purchased, a songwriter would make 9 cents for a whole song on either a purchased album or a purchased CD or a purchased cassette.
9 cents.
9 cents.
For each purchase.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, if you co-wrote a song with me, we'd each make 4.5 cents. Or if there were publishers involved,
we'll make a piece
up
of that 9
right.
cents. But the songwriter piece of the pie is 9 cents to be
right.
distributed or divided up somewhere.
Right.
Got
and,
it.
You know, that got a little bit, increased every year. And when albums were selling, if enough records sold, you were doing okay. But when that went away, that's not Spotify's fault that the album format went away. However, when streaming media companies came to be, the only way they could be in business was to have songs, content, my songs, and they needed to figure out a way to get those songs. They didn't need them from me, the songwriter. They needed them from the record labels.
Who owned the songs?
The masters.
Got it.
The master recordings. And the record labels weren't under these consent decrees. So when, well, let's say Spotify went to the labels and said, gee, we're starting this business and we need your product. The record label said, really? Well, here's how much it's going to cost. And it was crazy. And the record labels also said, and we want equity. We want to buy in. So they had to give them what they wanted because they wanted their product. So they got equity under non-disclosure agreements. We'll never know how much that was. Didn't necessarily share that with the artists who they're supposed to pay. And got the lion's share of the income, the royalties from all these stream songs. So Spotify will say, but wait a minute, songwriters, stop complaining. We pay out 70% of our revenue, of our profit to you, to the stakeholders, which is true. But what they don't tell public and everybody else is that 95% of the 70% that they pay out goes to the record label, and 5% goes to the songwriter and the publisher, and there's nothing we can do about it because we've been talking to the Department of Justice to look at those consent decrees again and say, let's make some changes. It's been 70 years since you've even amended anything, and how can you look at music, the distribution of music, and how songwriters are being paid in a digital universe, because it's a whole different language right now. So we are, my little group Sona here in LA, Songwriters of North America, doing a lot of work and advocating to try to get the DOJ to change things, to whisper in Hillary Clinton's ear, should she become the next president, to look a little bit more kindly at intellectual property rights, copyright law. Honestly, Bonnie, I think what's going to change, what it's going to take to change something, is we need a president or a judge on the Supreme Court to have a child who wants to be a rock star. And you will see things changed. I mean, you know, I don't want to say who I voted for in the last election, and maybe I did vote for President Obama, and maybe I do think he's a good guy. He's not the best when it came to intellectual property law. He's very favorable to tech. We're not, songwriters are not anti-internet. I like my streaming too. It's very versatile. I can stream music. Although I pay for it, I would never do a freemium model. I could listen to music wherever I want to, as much as I want to, wherever I want to. It's just that if a dollar is paid out for the streaming of a song, I don't think that it's okay that the labels get 95 cents and the songwriters and publishers get 5. There's got to be a more even distribution of income from streaming. That's all we're saying. We're not trying to say ixnay on the eaming stray.
Yeah.
We're just saying, it's here to stay. Let's be partners.
I like that. That makes sense. Because it's clearly here to stay. We're not going to...
We're cool,
you know,
with it.
Put that genie back in the bottle.
Right.
And it's got
a lot
of upsides.
And we don't want to.
Yeah. Well, it makes your music available to more people. But that's not an adequate reason for you to not get paid fairly.
Nobody would walk into a restaurant and say, I want a free meal, and I'll tell all my friends, and so they'll come and give you more business. How are they going to pay for that?
But then
the meals are going to stop being cooked.
Exactly.
Not only can they afford to do it,
not pay that, but the friends will come and expect free meals too, which is how that metaphor actually plays out.
And the food's going to start, I don't want to use that word, the food's going to start paling.
It'll
You're not
going to
have yummy meals, right?
Yeah. Well, which is what's going to happen here pretty soon, as you know, top-notch songwriters
are going to fall by the wayside because they can't support themselves.
Exactly. And they've got families. Exactly. I mean, these are the real humans with families and mortgages and car payments and grocery bills. And, you know, if the thing that they are brilliant at that has changed the lives of millions of people, you know, this is the song I played at my wedding. This is the song I played when my child was born. This is the song I fell in love to. If the quality of those songs deteriorates, we all suffer, you know, and I really do hope that some kind of breakthrough can happen, you know, sooner than later. Mm-hmm. It's clearly inevitable because, you know, history really is on the side of justice. It's just so slow sometimes, you know, so
really
I'm glad
so.
That you're doing this work.
Yeah.
Well, so who is making money in music these days?
Well, if you have a big hit on terrestrial radio, which is the radio you listen to when you go in your car, not interactive streaming, you can make a windfall from that, unless there are 15 writers on that song. If you're on a really huge hit where there were 4 writers, you can make a substantial amount of income. But terrestrial radio is going away. It's all going to be streaming. So even those writers, the Max Martins, are getting very concerned because, you know, and let's put it this way, even if you had a hit on terrestrial radio last year and you made $50,000, well, you lost $50,000 because the part that was streamed, you didn't really make money on. So that's not fair.
Mm-mm.
And I don't care if somebody's has a huge hit and they're a millionaire, or they had a mini hit and they made $10,000. We put in our hours. We've worked for decades, you know, waited a lot of tables to write that one song that was a hit. It's not like we were an overnight success and got a single and made, you know, $250,000. We worked really hard for that and slept in a lot of holes in order to work up to that one song. So, you know, Clint Eastwood would never be in a movie and they'd say, can you do this for free?
Yeah.
He worked really hard. And they should earn what is due to them.
Well, and creative and intellectual property are real work, just as much as any other real work that is a little more
but
tangible.
Tech people would like you to think, we should share all photographs on the internet. Everything should be free on the internet. And wait till a young person decides to write a novel or write a poem. And anything that could be monetized via the internet, in that case, will not be able to be your profession.
Yeah, I mean, how could you make money
so
as a novelist?
Just gonna,
yeah, exactly. This applies all across the board to
anything
that
could be monetized on.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, so this I've been watching this for a while from the sidelines because I just am interested as a human, and of course I've got a daughter who's in the industry, so I have a personal stake in it. And it's so frustrating. What can listeners do to help? Is there anything just normal people can do to help artists, like, in this fight?
Yes. I think that what they need not do is listen to music for free.
Cool.
If they're going to stream, and I assume they are, subscribe. If everybody subscribed, would that change the livelihood of songwriters? Not that much, incrementally. But what it does is it elongates the perception that music has value. The more we get into a music is free culture, and the more we access music for free, we're never going to get our children to pay for it. We're never going to get them to believe or to have the mindset that music has value, that the people who are making it worked really hard. There was a lot of sweat and tears that went into that. And they deserve to be compensated fairly. And so that when we figure out a way to make a more even distribution, if people are subscribing, the songwriters will get more of a piece of that. So, you know, I tell my daughter, don't download for free, don't participate in piracy, you know. Even on iTunes, you know, the iTunes downloading platform is going away. You're not going to be able to buy albums, download, pay for the download. It's all going to be streamed.
That upsets me. Yeah. I just have to say, I just found out about that, and that just makes me crazy.
Yeah.
I hate that.
Yeah. It
makes me mad.
Yeah. So don't go to pirate sites. Just, you know, think of it as something that you might manufacture one day, that you might put forth one day, and, you know, somebody just takes it because they can. There's some ethics involved here.
Yeah. Well, it's just like walking into a store and just taking something and walking out. It's like, that's not okay.
Yeah.
It's just not,
mm-hmm.
you know? So if you were talking to a young songwriter today, what advice would you give them?
I would say be proactive. Find out how you can make a difference. Invest in trying to prop up your future profession, or else you might not be able to make a living. Take some time during every day and do something you can. Sign a petition, write your congressman, get in touch with Sona, and we'll tell you what you could do to make a difference. And then put time aside every day to forget about all that and get in touch with your muse and be creative. And don't ask yourself, but what am I going to do with this? Who's going to cut it? Will somebody sign me? Enjoy your creativity. And don't forget what drives you and what you wanted to do it for in the first place. I'm practicing these words I preach. Trying to stay connected to that girl who sat down at a piano and said, "Heavens above, speak to me, let something fall." You know, don't lose touch with that.
That is so beautiful. I think any one of us who identifies as an artist knows what you're speaking to right now. There's nothing like that. There's nothing like that sense of being connected to something greater than yourself that maybe you're channeling or maybe you're articulating in some way. And I know that it's made my life, you know, infinitely richer to have that access mm-hmm. when I have had mm-hmm. it. You want to speak to that just a little bit more? Like what drives you as an artist?
Thank you for calling me as an artist.
You're an
artist.
Because
I really feel like I am. I've never made my own record, but I feel like I'm a, what is it when you attract things? I'm in my own orbit, and I don't feel like I get up every day and write something cookie cutter. I really feel like I could have made a record if it was a different time. I honestly, Bonnie, I have deep respect for the part of me that is unique. Am I as prolific as some other people? Maybe not, but I know I have a certain voice, and she speaks to me when I'm not trying to force her to come out, when I'm not following somebody else's voice or saying, I want to write like this or I want to write like that. When I am unmindful of it, it just comes to me. I'm a vessel, is the word I was looking for.
Yes.
What drives me is the constant connection to her, because when I find her, whether I make money from her or not, I feel really valuable and authentic. And now I feel like we've come full circle from the first thing you asked me, which was about Rotten to the Core. And did I know? And I didn't, but I cared about that song because it felt like it came from, I felt like I channeled it from somewhere, that I wasn't building it, or it wasn't contrived. It was real.
I would say maybe organic and had its own integrity. It was of a piece.
Yeah.
My experience with creating things is that the more kind of complete they show up, generally the stronger they are.
The more what they show up?
Complete, like of a piece, like all at once, mm-hmm. or without excessive tinkering uh-huh. necessary to make them shore up, you know?
Yeah.
It's not yeah. always true. I mean,
It isn't, but often it just like hits you like a bomb.
Right.
You're like, I've realized it. I know exactly what it should be. I love when that happens. It's fantastic.
There's nothing like it. So, is there anything else you'd like to share?
Oh. Well, something that you and I were talking about, I think, before we started the interview, and that, I think it was before we started the interview, and that is, no matter what generation you are, to stay creative. And when you stop dreaming, as I feel like I sort of stopped a few years ago when the industry just changed so much, and I'd sit in my office and look at all the records on my wall, and I'd say, why aren't I getting any as many as I used to? It wasn't me. It was albums stopped selling. Why isn't my phone ringing as much? Is it me? Is it me? And when I wrote my book, I thought, you know, it's not me. It's the industry, and I've got to change the way I'm navigating in it, and I've got to stay in touch with my joy. When we stop dreaming as human beings, whether we're 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 or 60, that's when we get old, and I feel younger than I did 10 years ago. I think we always have to wake up and have a dream in our heart.
Well, this is perfect. So let's talk about that book for a minute, because your book is a perfect example of you, you know, finding a new path for yourself in the world. And I'm not going to say reinventing yourself, because you're still a songwriter,
mm-hmm.
but now you are also
an author.
And, you know, as a writer, this whole idea is very dear to me, but I really do believe that writing is a great way for you to discover things that you didn't know were true. You know, the process of writing,
mm-hmm.
you really do that for people. So how did that process go for you? What was it like to write a book about your life as a songwriter? And
I didn't know I was doing it when I started. I was blogging a lot, and I had some stories because friends of mine who were on the TV side had wanted to maybe put a show together to pitch about songwriting, and they had asked me to write all these little stories about anecdotes about sessions, and I had them, and the show never really took off, but I had these stories, and I thought, you know, nobody's talking about what's going on. I think songwriters don't want to say, well, it's changed for me, I'm not getting as many cuts as I used to, my phone isn't ringing, and I thought, why aren't we talking about it? And I felt like once I did start putting these stories out there, people would say, oh, that's happening to me too. And I thought, well, maybe there's a story here that hasn't been written. So the book started out as a compilation of these stories, but as I got further into it, I realized it's not just a compilation of these stories. It's an emotional arc. I started when I was in my 20s, and here I am in my 50s. And I feel that I needed to dismiss some of the stories and incorporate more that showed the change in my maturity and where I'm at now. They say, you know, writing a memoir is really all about the author finding their identity. And I really found out so much about myself, and where I can't write as a 50-year-old woman the way I did as a 20-year-old. And that's okay.
It is okay.
And I don't want to get mad at the 20-year-old. It's not their fault that they're young. I was young, you know? So, I mean, I did something with Idina Menzel a couple of months ago, and that was brilliant because she's an adult, and she got where my head was at, and I knew where she was coming from, and we had this beautiful conversation, and we're like, there's a song, you know? And I'm happy to get in the room with a younger person and say, let me help you bake your cake. What are you thinking? I was there. I have diaries from when I was 18. That's a different experience. And I'm not going to get mad at that anymore. I'm just not going to do that every day because I need a little bit from Adina, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just got very clear on that in writing the book. And now I'm going around to talk to students at all these colleges in the fall. And because they'll be in their 20s and I feel that it's a time also for me to give back. I don't know if I'll ever write another hit. I thank the universe for the 5 that I did write because I am still supporting myself on them. And I can write for the joy and not worry about, oh my God, am I going to be able to pay my mortgage? But talk to young people. It's a time I just want to wake up every day with purpose and feel what I'm doing is important. I feel like I have a lot more clarity. And now I want to talk to young people about your other question. What would you tell young people? You need to be responsible if this is what you want to do. So I don't really know where I'm headed, Bonnie. I just feel like I'm putting one foot in front of the other, and I feel like I'm doing meaningful work. And if I write one song a week, so be it. I'm not in the studio every day, nor do I want to be. I want to just balance my time in between my blogging, which I feel is very cathartic, and talking to people like you. You know, we've got this thing in common. And I'll never stop writing songs, you know. I'm spreading it out a little bit more. A lot of different creative worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's working right now. Who knows what's going to happen next year?
Well, you know, you were talking about the book and how its origins were, you know, little scenes for a possible TV show, which is just fascinating. And there are so many amazing stories in that book. The book is really a joy to read. I really loved it.
I can't wait to read yours.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm pretty pleased with my book. I feel good about it.
I can't wait.
It's like, yay, something I feel good about.
Mm-hmm.
But there were so many amazing, crazy stories. I mean, you have some crazy, extraordinary stories in that book. Is there a favorite story that stands out that you want to share?
Maybe the one about Chrissy Hynde when my camera died and I didn't get the photo op, and you know, somebody photoshopped a picture of my head on a torso next to her body, and that's the moment I have of us together and the joy I had just her championing me. I mean, like, you know, she cut a song of mine after it was already cut by an established group. I mean, who does that now? They're like, no, someone cut it, I'm never gonna cut that song. And announced my name, and it was just so much joy in that. And then also, you know, writing Bitch after so many years of bad news and wrong information, and I'm driving down the hill with my pregnant belly, and I hear it on the radio, and I had just sort of surrendered to the universe and said, whatever happens, happens, and there it was. I think that there's a lot of surrendering that is involved in receiving success. And there's a freedom in surrendering. If you try too hard, if you're looking at your numbers, if you're checking your analytics, it's like, oh, just put the best energy you can out there. And hopefully you'll be rewarded by what? I don't know. It's unexplainable.
I love that.
Thank you.
I love that. I think I want to end on that. That's just beautiful.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, this has been so fun. Well, so how can people find you?
So I have a website, shellypeikin.com, and it's SHELLYPEIKEN. Thank you for showing me this because it's hard to remember them all. My Facebook page, which I would invite anybody to find, like, and jump in on the conversations, young and mature, music maker or music lover, is facebook.com/serial songwriter, not the cereal that you have for breakfast. S E R I A L songwriter.
So if you're on Facebook, just Serial Songwriter.
Serial Songwriter. My Instagram is simply Shelley Piken, S-H-E-L-L-Y-P-E-I-K-E-N. And Twitter is Shelley _ Piken. So find me, chat me. I get very chatty on Facebook, and I'm happy to jump into a conversation on my page in a thread or privately with anybody that's aspiring to get into the business. I'm happy to chat.
Shelley, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time. Thanks for listening to Hometown to Hollywood. If you like what you heard here, subscribe to this free podcast and leave a quick rating and review. A moment to click on a star rating really helps, and a minute to write a sentence-long review makes a real difference in the ranking for this podcast. Thank you so much for helping me. Do you want to know more about getting a young actor up and running in Hollywood? Buy my book, The Hollywood Parents Guide, on Amazon. And if you need specific help getting your career or your child's career up and running or to the next level, you can get a one-on-one consultation with me over Skype or in person in Los Angeles. Go to my website, hollywoodparentsguide.com, and click on the consultations page. Thanks, and see you next week.